This is March 30th, 2008, and this will be the second of two consecutive teshos on sex and the third precept. Last week's tesho was, I tried to emphasize our animal nature and speak to the science and the genetics of how deep runs our conditioning to want to have sex. That Taisho recording was malfunctioned, and we don't have a recording, so I'm just going to, for less than 2 minutes, touch on some of those things from last week, because I think it's really essential that we understand and make peace with our animal nature. I think one of the obstacles that American Zen students are up against is our Puritan forebears, and what many people of many countries of the world consider our prudishness and our tendency to be sexually repressed, and then have it come out in the other extreme, but more on that later. I read a lot from a book last week called The Anatomy of Love, The Natural History of Monogamy, Adultery, and Divorce by a distinguished anthropologist by the name of Helen Fisher. And in it, she makes a very strong case, as do many of her colleagues and biologists, that that we are charged, genetically charged, to reproduce. And there's only one way anyone has ever found to reproduce. And so that is coiled in us, our sexual drive. And it's we can no more deny it than we can deny our other drives like hunger and sleep. As we'll hear, the fact that we have this charge, this basic genetic mandate, doesn't mean that we need to act on it, or even that we're aware of it, particularly. I myself have never, for a moment in my life, wanted to have children. But there have been a few moments when I wanted to have sex. Just a little bit more from Helen Fisher about how deep is this conditioning? It's and in particular the biological conditioning. We cannot deny our bodies and their own tendencies, dispositions. As long as we have bodies, we have hormones, and those hormones will influence us until the day we die. At the age of about 6 weeks, the fetus begins to distinguish itself sexually, where our hormones, testosterone and androgen, sex the fetal brain. And she makes the case that these gender differences came across the centuries out of our distant past when ancestral men and women began to pair and raise their young as, quote, husband and, quote, wife. She presents research that there's a continuum of these sexual hormones. And in fact, we can, I think most people would agree that we're not either heterosexual or homosexual. We're not either male or female, that we're a mixture of these dispositions or tones or melodies. Each one of us is that. And she presents a study that where girls who receive abnormally high doses of male hormones in the womb exhibit tomboyish behavior in childhood and do better on math exams as teenagers. And pubescent boys with low levels of testosterone do poorly on spatial tasks. Just a little more here. She poses the question, is biology destiny? Not at all. No one denies that culture plays an enormous role in molding human action. But it is unscientific to overlook some equally significant facts. The body of data on gender differences in infants, the persistence of male-female differences on tests other than the SATs, the fact that adolescent girls do not fall behind on other tasks because of social pressure, and the corroborative data from other countries, and the literature linking testosterone with spatial skills, and estrogen, with verbal aptitude, all support the view that the sexes do indeed exhibit gender differences in some spatial and verbal abilities. This will not be news to many people here, but that over and over and over again, men show a greater aptitude for spatial and visual skills, and women greater aptitude for verbal and intuitive skills. Of course, there are exceptions. Again, it's another continuum. She says, I can only add that from an anthropological perspective, these gender differences make evolutionary sense. As ancestral males began to scout and track and surround animals millennia ago, those males who were good at maps and mazes could well have survived disproportionately. Ancestral women needed to locate vegetable foods within an elaborate matrix of vegetation instead, so they developed a superior ability to remember the locations of stationary objects, a different spatial talent. And for women whose job it was to rear the young, verbal skills may have been critical as well. Hence, I will argue that as pair bonding emerged and the human hunting-gathering scavenging tradition took shape, so did these subtle gender differences in aptitude. We'll come back to all this as we get into specific things about pornography and all. And then she also presents a lot of study in a certain tribe, African tribe called the Kung, KUNG. That again establishes the normalcy of men as of both men and women as having more than one partner over a lifetime, not simultaneously, in one marriage, but. That too is something that is more very common in other species, as well as we know today, adultery. Now, although we all have this genetic mandate to reproduce, we of course don't have to play it out sexually. And the basic, what I always got from Roshi Kaplow as far as the third precept, didn't get much, but what we heard in Taisho was that, and that he got this from Yasutani Roshi in Japan, was that when we speak of not misusing sexuality, it, as far as specific prohibitions, it means not having adultery, not having sex with a mentally retarded person, or you could say mentally retarded or mentally disturbed, I think is a broader, mentally retarded or mentally disturbed person, not having sex with an underage person, and of course, obviously, rape. But beyond that, there wasn't much. Why stay loyal to your spouse? Well, aside from the fact that it's there, you've taken a vow to do so, what do we lose in terms of practice, in terms of our Zen practice, our the three treasures, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha? Well, the most obvious reason is that it causes harm. It causes pain and suffering. And I think this is the measure that we can apply to every kind of sexual activity. Does it cause harm? Does it cause pain or not? And if it does, to what degree? How much harm or pain does it cause? We have this listserv on our Zen Teachers Association, the AZTA, American Zen Teachers Association, and people throw out email, they throw out questions soliciting the experience and sometimes advice of other teachers. And just this last week, coincidentally, there was some teacher who, I don't even know who it was, said, I have a student who's reporting that his eyes are wandering, a married student who's having longing feelings toward another woman. Anyone have any advice on what, any specific practices is what he said. And there were a few that people threw out. There's a traditional Buddhist practice, not in Zen, but in other kinds of Buddhism, where you visualize the object of your desire, the other person, as having no skin, and seeing, you know, underneath that, where you see all the viscera and the fluids and the urine and everything else. It has a real monastic tone to it. I've never tried that. Strikes me as just a little too weird, although possibly effective. I welcome any kind of feedback if anyone wants to try that and report back. What I said, and this is like the first time I've found the interest of time. Well, I never read these emails. I don't have the time, but this one just caught my eye. And I said, well, here's something you might have your student try is reflecting on the pain that you would most likely, not for sure, but most likely cause your spouse and a lot of other people, your children, your parents, your siblings, your community, your neighbors, your co-workers, colleagues, and your Sangha. And I think this is, it sounds pretty simple, rudimentary, but I think it has real effectiveness. The trouble is that when people are infatuated with someone other than their spouse and they're contemplating, they're usually so worked up over their attraction to that person that they have a way of compartmentalizing it so that they find a way not to think about that, about the pain that this affair could cause. So that's our tendency, is to just focus on the object of our desire and nothing else. There again comes our biological and genetic conditioning, is for men to spread our seed and for women to maximum the acquisition of resources in more than one partner, more than one sexual partner. But if you can pause, and you can call it a visualization practice if you want, picture the stricken faces of your spouse and your family and friends and coworkers and all, your Sangha. Just picture those faces, the disappointed, maybe disgusted faces. But before we can even do that, we have to be aware, we have to notice the kind of state we're getting into over these adulterous thoughts, these fantasies and cravings for this other person who's not our spouse. And there are a lot of similarities between the sex drive and and our basic aggression as creatures, as territorial creatures, competing for resources. Some of you have heard me say repeatedly in Taisho, Taisho's on anger, that the first step, and arguably the most important step, is to notice when you're feeling angry. And that's not so obvious often, because we're so consumed with the thought of the object of our anger, that person. She did this, he said that, I'm going to get back, I'll tell you. And we actually are can be in a state of oblivion about our own anger. And so the same works with our sexual, our blind passions for someone outside of marriage. I'm just talking now about marriage. Same thing is to notice it. And that's not necessarily so easily done. Because the state of this feverish state of desire can make us unaware of what's going on in our own minds. Once we can open up a little space there, then we have some freedom. Same with anger. Once we notice, I'm getting angry here, or, oh, I'm getting attracted to this person, I'm going crazy, I'm getting crazy over this person, then we can start choosing of how to go from there. And that's one way, is to consider the kind of suffering that could ensue from that. Of course, we may not get caught in our adulterous affair, but an awful lot of times it happens, and that would be the time to concentrate on that possibility and not the other. And this choosing of what to do, creating a space through awareness, and then choosing how to act there, whether to act out on our thoughts and fantasies or not, has a certain analogy in computers. I talked this past week, I talked with some of my students who are much more knowledgeable about computers. I had a basic sense that it could work, and I didn't know enough about computers to do so. But for those of you who may want to consider this, it's like the relationship of a computer's basic input-output system, BIOS, and the software that we run on the computer. So we have our basic genetic predispositions, the sexual drive itself, our animal nature, the hormones that are pulsing through us all the time. That is like the most rudimentary code that runs a computer, this basic input-output system. It runs in the background, this system, and goes largely unnoticed by most computer users. It boots up the computer and sets into place the foundation for the computer's functioning. We don't really choose to run this basic input-output system, this basic code. And we rarely ever tinker with the settings of it. However, once the computer is up and running, we can choose which software to run, whether it's Microsoft Word or Internet Explorer or others. We have some measure of how the computer is put to use. We have some choice. And this is what distinguishes us from our just primitive animal functioning, and this is what makes us human. Choice, attention, where are we putting our attention? Shakespeare had so many profound things to say, but when I think of adultery, I think of these words of his: momentary joy breeds months of pain, or years. But, and of course, pain to others, unless you're a sociopath, translates to pain for yourself. But this is simply on the level of causing harm to others and to oneself. There's a positive reason to maintain fidelity with one's spouse. And that is because there is so much practice opportunity in that commitment, of following through with that commitment. Another Buddhist teacher, Pema Chodron, in talking about finding a teacher, she said, "Find a teacher and let him put you through your changes." I infer from that she's saying, find a teacher, stick with him or her, and let her put you through your changes. And I think it's a perfect application for marital fidelity. Find a spouse and let him or her put you through your changes. No moving. That's the value of not moving while we're sitting. If we can't squirm out of it, if we can't get away from what we have to face while sitting, what we have to face with a teacher, what we have to face with a spouse or a partner, if we can't wiggle our way out of it when we're facing ourselves, that's what it comes down to, then we're more likely to see through this self or this so-called other. That's why marriage can be such an extraordinarily powerful vehicle for practice. Because in marriage or in any committed relationship, it doesn't have to be marriage, or living in a married state, we're always facing ourselves. This other who is usually so different from us in so many ways is ourself. It's like facing Mu. Mu is a practice of deepening intimacy. And if we just get exasperated with Mu or frustrated or angry and then use that as a reason to cut and run, then we're not going to see that Mu is our very own mind. The same with an intimate relationship with a person. Aitken Roshi, in talking about marriage and its highest potential, said, "We agree to love and honor our practice of marriage more than each other." We love and honor intimacy with these so-called other and see that that other is not an object separate from us as a self. And we're not going to realize that if we flee into extramarital relationships. Now, the other side, as far as marriage and divorce, people change. We marry, we take vows of merit of marriage, and people change. And there may come a time, as we all know, when our karma could be exhausted with that person. And it's time to dissolve that relationship. Now, I got to be careful because I don't have that experience, but it's marriage and relationships are not essential commitments. They're worldly commitments, and people change. The relationship changes. We may drift apart. We find that we don't have we're not eye to eye anymore. We're not facing in the same direction, which is one way that. To understand marriage, it's not like you're just forever lovingly gazing at one another, but you're facing in the same direction. And when these things happen, then it may be time to get divorced and move on. I don't see divorce as wrong, but how hard have you tried? That's the question, because every marriage involves conflict. And challenges and scrapping and quarreling with one another and working through those. And in that way, it's like it's Mu, it's breath practice. It's getting frustrated, getting angry, getting discouraged with this self and this so-called other. How hard do you want to try to get beyond the differences, the opposition? Adultery involves deception in this regard. It's a violation of the fourth precept as well, not to lie but to speak the truth. Unless the couple has an agreement of free marriage where either one can get involved with someone else, I'm very skeptical about whether that's anything but some kind of mutual joined avoidance of the real promise and potential of marriage. But I don't know. Also, back to this compartmentalizing that's part of adultery, I suppose. You're blocking out and doing that and carrying on an illicit affair, a secret, a clandestine affair. You're blocking out the consequences, the pain. And in practice is fundamentally a practice of integrating, not not compartmentalize, it's decompartmentalizing. We're trying in practice to own every aspect of ourself, to open to and collect, integrate these different aspects of our nature. Adultery is supported by thoughts and fantasies and daydreams, of course. These and thoughts and fantasies and daydreams are important contributing factors, not only to adultery, but to other violations of this precept. One of the other teachers in this case, where the question was, what do I, any specific advice for this student who is contemplating having an adulterous affair? Another teacher said simply, don't follow your thoughts. That's a good one. Don't follow your thoughts and fantasies. We have some freedom here to know to how we use, where we direct our attention. This may not be easy. We know that from sitting, but we get better at it. The story here about Roshi being asked about this precept as for himself. This was in the mid-70s. He was conducting a workshop at York University in Toronto before a packed auditorium. The question and answer period was polite, in the Canadian manner, until one young man asked, Roshi, when was the last time you had a sexual fantasy? Pause for dramatic effect. Roshi replied, oh, about an hour ago when this beautiful Chinese woman got on the elevator with us. He said, and then she got off the elevator, the doors closed, and she was gone. That was it. His reply there was really brought the house down. Then later, the man raised his hand again, and Roshi called on him, and the man asked, did you act on it? And Roshi said, there was a time when I would have. Now, these fantasies are like uninvited guests. I neither pay attention to them nor try to make them leave. Before long, they leave of their own accord. This is good, solid advice. I think we are just as disposed to have sexual fantasies and thoughts as we are anything else sexual. That's part of this charge that we're born with and carry through our life. So they happen. They happen to everyone, I assume. But happen, what does that mean? They arise, you notice them, and you let go of them. And then, so what? It's no big deal. It's nursing them. It's chewing on them. It's working them, weaving them. This is where we get away from our true nature. And this leads us into other questions that have come up to me in Doksan about this precept. That's why I felt compelled to finally give a teisho on this, is because there seems to be a lot of misunderstanding or fear about these matters, And as I go on now, I'm going to be direct and frank in these things I'm speaking about, and earthy at times, because that's the nature. That's what this is all about. And to just speak in vague generalities, I think, leaves too many people wondering. So, okay, for example, homosexuality. I was surprised when I first had someone say to me as a teacher, could I say anything in Taisho about homosexuality and whether that's a violation of this precept? I was surprised because I never thought that people would consider it a violation of it so long as the homosexual activity is like any sexual activity, it's a sharing and not a using or brutalizing or exploiting another. So long as it comes out of caring and some form of loving feeling. So I would certainly say that if those are the conditions, if it's done in that spirit, then I don't see it as a violation at all. Homosexuality is not something we choose to be. Maybe that's too absolute a statement. I think bisexuality has become quite fashionable among young people. I hear this from my wife, who is a clinical psychologist, and she says that there's so much gender confusion among teenagers and some people in their 20s, I guess. And it's almost cool to identify yourself as bisexual. And that label doesn't always square with the person's activities. Going back to Helen Fisher's book, there's research showing that homosexuality, genuine homosexuality, is determined largely by sex hormones. We don't have a lot of choice in that. So that's homosexuality. What else that has come up? Pornography. And masturbation, which is about, you know, they pretty much always go together. In this book, Helen Fisher's book, she talks about masturbation as being pretty much universal among other creatures, dolphins, gorillas, it would seem to be pretty much universal among humans from everything I've read. She cites a researcher who offers the hypothesis that nocturnal emissions and masturbation are the result of sperm competition between males, a pleasurable way to replace old sperm with new. I think in our culture, maybe all cultures, male masturbation is there's more shame that goes along with it, maybe because it's messier, or I don't know. But in talking about the third precept, you know, talking about any precept, there's a whole range of violations. The serious ones are the ones we already mentioned for this precept: adultery and sex with underage and mentally disturbed people and rape, the obvious ones. Something like masturbation, and certainly nocturnal emissions, wet dreams. Nocturnal emissions are involuntary, they're in your sleep, so certainly that's not a violation of the precept. Masturbation, it's volitional. In that case, in the sense that it is, your mind is not present. Your mind is not present or empty. So strictly speaking, you could say to choose to let your mind flee into images and fantasies, that's kind of a very faint betrayal of your true nature. But who doesn't violate the precept in some subtle, any precept in some subtle way? If we're judging ourselves for these very minor, insignificant violations of the precepts, we're more likely to drag around shame and unnecessary shame. So masturbation is a way to pleasure yourself, and it certainly doesn't cause harm to anyone else. People should just relax about that. And I wish I'd been told that about 30 years, 50 years ago. I was mostly celibate through my 20s when the testosterone is raging in males, and you realize then, especially through wet dreams, that you don't. This is a force. This sexual drive is a force that is more, sometimes more than one can handle. It's no pun intended. It's something that will out one way or another, and I would certainly see masturbation as less harmful than indiscriminate promiscuous sex, potentially. Now this is something that, one of many aspects of this precept that I don't feel on solid ground with, and I have to just speak from my own experience. I went through a kind of what I think of as my Don Juan period in, I don't know, 18 to 20, something like that, where I was just, it seems like 2 years of one-night stands, one after another, and it started to wear a little thin after a while, and I came to feel increasing guilt about using women, so many women, one after another. I got to the point where I thought I could sort of exonerate myself by announcing to a woman when I met her and we were headed for bed, you know, I've got a bad history of one night stands, and I got to tell you, I don't know, but that's the kind of guy you're sleeping with now. I just don't, you know, you're not, if history is any guide, you're not likely to see me again. And what I didn't realize, I was so naive, is that at that moment she doesn't care, you know, because she's gonna be different. This is human nature, not just female. It's human nature. Okay, in the throes of sexual passion, okay, who cares about your past? This is now. This is, I'm a new person, and anything is possible as far as, you know, having a nice long relationship together. And then when I saw that that didn't work, you know, a warning label, consumer warning label, then I had to face the fact that I was just causing too much pain to others and to myself. And then I, so often the case, I just swung in the other direction, one extreme to the other. And then, except for a couple, three very brief encounters, I was celibate throughout my 20s and into my 30s. And for me, that was a nice way to simplify my life here on staff, which was basically a monastic life. And it does simplify things. It was such a liberation to have that whole element of relationships cut out of my life, and to be able to focus all that sexual energy, which means just basically energy. Sexual energy is just a form of energy. To be able to apply it all to practice, to sitting and with my koan, probing, penetrating my koan. And let's be clear about that, that there are many ways to sublimate this primordial sexual drive of human beings, and practice is one of them. Sports, of course, research, all kinds of ways, and practice. Practice for a male, the male energy is what I just said. It's this probing, deepening, penetrating energy. And for the female, I suppose, it's the sense of merging, embracing. Well, for both, it's merging. But I don't know. I won't speak about women. It's a superb way until, and then finally, I'd gotten far enough in my practice and that I was able to re-enter relationships on a less unhealthy basis. And went on from there. Now, internet sex. I said to someone recently, I'm sure glad the internet was not around when I was in my teens and 20s. I talked to one of my students who admitted to having an internet sex addiction, and asked the person him. Does that surprise anyone? Actually, this is a little peripheral thing, which is the male tendency, the male tendency to play out our sex drive through imagery, visually. More than women, I'm saying. This, I'm guessing that a lot of you have heard this advanced, or just know it anecdotally or intuitively, that this seems to be a male thing. I mentioned earlier about the more spatial brains of men. She writes here, Helen Fisher, we may have some sexual tastes that come from our distant past as well. Some men are voyeurs. Some like to look at visual porn, I would say more than some. Others have an indefatigable love for erotic underwear, nighties. And sex gadgets. In fact, men's sexual fantasies are regularly aroused by visual stimuli of all sorts. Perhaps these partialities are in part directed by their more spatial brains. Women like romance novels and soap operas on television, tepid verbal porn. Now, this is a woman who's writing that. Maybe these inclinations, she writes, arise from their sensitivity to language. And then, of course, she says, not to say that all men are voyeurs, all men feel blah, 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 blah. But let's call a spade here. Men, the pornography and visual sex trade is, most of the customers are men. You know what? We're out of time. I didn't want to make this into three, but I feel obliged to do so. You can stay away next time. but I get into some interesting things next time. Yeah, well, just as a preview, a trailer... more on pornography, fetishes, internet chat, strip clubs, prostitution, sadomasochism, oral anal sex, sex toys, games, threesomes, group sex. most of these things are very brief. But with that, we'll stop and recite the four of us.